Hello again out there, podcast listeners, and welcome to episode number 2 of Talk Sports, our adventures in the lively art of conversation. I'm your host, Peter Michaels, joined by my good friend, sidekick, and nemesis, Roscoe. We'll be discussing just about anything that touches our hearts or our funny bones, and sometimes both, even sports on occasion. Good morning, Roscoe.
Good morning, Gary.
How are you?
I'm terrific. I had a birthday this week.
You had
a birthday this week as well.
Well, in fact, my birthday is today, and thank you for the card.
I didn't give you a card.
Well, here's what you could do.
I brought you a present.
Here's what you could do for me. There's a very famous Leslie Gore song from a movie. I thought maybe you could give me a verse or two.
Would that be, my life is sunshine, lollipops and rainbows, everything that's wonderful is sure to come your... I've got a cold. Way. I can't get there. But Leslie Gore, we just watched
Ski Party.
Ski Party, 1965.
Sort of a sequel to Beach Blanket Bingo.
Right.
Avalon's in that movie.
Yes, they couldn't wait until summer and they wanted to cash in on the winter, so they did Ski Party.
She sings it on a bus.
She sings it on a bus in the middle of the aisle, and the other college students are on the bus, and they all look to be between 35 and 40.
And they're all going from, like, the beaches of L.A. to Tahoe.
To an unknown mountain, yes.
Just to sing on an unknown mountain. Well, thank you for that rendition. My life does feel like rainbows and lollipops today. Well, it's a lovely day outside. We finally got a glimpse, a whisper, a zephyr of springtime. It's in the 40s out there, and it's almost time for summer.
Yeah, practically. It's almost time for summer.
Where did the winter go?
Can spring be far behind?
Where did the winter go?
Oh, my Lord. I barely survived this winter.
But listen, speaking of...
The fact that I didn't freeze to death in an alley like George McGovern's daughter is beyond me.
And the heat situation in your apartment is just unbearable. It goes off. It goes off in the middle of the night for several hours.
I wake up freezing and screaming.
Well, that's what you get for living in an SRO.
Yes, it's very sad.
It is sad.
Rude et unfashionable.
And speaking of SRO, let's talk about the Grand Park Music Festival coming up, because it's going to be summer any second now.
Any second.
And there's some wonderful things on the program, and I wanted to ask your opinion about them. First of all, they're opening the season with a concert that's going to feature music from Bernstein's Fancy Free. Do you know this musical?
Yes, Fancy Free was the piece that On the Town was later based on. Fancy Free was a short ballet, I think 45 minutes. They expanded it to On the Town, which is Adolf Green. Betty Comden and Adolf
Comden
Green.
And Green.
Comden yeah. and Green and Bernstein. How can you go wrong? I'll tell you how you can go wrong. You revive it on Broadway. You get great reviews. You play in a gigantic house that no one wants to go to. And no one comes.
That revival has
been playing since the fall. It's playing at 30% capacity. They practically stopped. Someone read something online that there's a forlorn young boy dressed as a sailor walking up and down Broadway, passing out flyers saying, we'll let you into this goddamn show for free. Just show up and fill a seat, and everyone turns him down. So few people are coming that if you buy a seat in the balcony or the mezzanine during the week, they just say, oh, for God's sake, sit downstairs. The actors think someone is here.
Please, you're sitting in the front row.
Sit in the front row.
So they can actually see people with the footlights on.
But it's a tragic. It's losing $500,000.
I don't know how something like that can stay open.
Deep pockets.
And now there's going to be this stage version of An American in Paris, which I saw some production photos of recently. It looks thrilling.
Well, I was just with some wealthy people from the northern suburbs last night who had seen An American in Paris in Paris. And they said the ballet was fantastic.
Is that all they said?
Yeah, I sort of cut her off. I didn't care.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out.
All right.
Anyway, they're following that up with a Sondheim celebration. We usually make it a plan to go to these things, especially the
Broadway
stuff.
If it's not too hot or too cold or you're not in a bad mood or worried about encroachment,
yes. Sondheim night. Remember, it was 105 in the shade, and you sat next to me.
And that must have been unpleasant and grueling for you.
My skin could barely breathe. And lastly, one last show that I thought of note, our good friend, Kurt Elling. Will be doing an evening on August 12th of jazz. He's going to have a little sort of, little big band. Can you say that? Yeah. It's going to be a big band kind of thing with brass, and it's going to, but not going to be, it's going to be with the orchestra as well. Anyway, that's a couple of the highlights on the Grand Park Music Festival schedule. Of course, there's much more.
Are there a lot of morose requiems that we'll be subjected to in July?
Yeah, probably, you know.
Let's go to Grant Park and listen to really depressing music while we swelter and eat grapes.
And let's just hope that on the 4th of July weekend, the prevailing winds are not from the south, because everybody in Grant Park and at the pavilion will be stoned out of their minds from a contact high from the Grateful Dead concerts happening at Soldier Field.
Is that the same weekend?
Three nights. I think it's the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, or the 3rd, 4th, and 5th.
Have you been to a Grateful Dead concert?
No.
I have been to a Grateful Dead concert.
How did you enjoy it? Do you remember?
Yes. I was clean and sober that night, and I only went because a friend of mine loved the Grateful Dead forever, and I said, I need to experience this. So I went to a Grateful Dead concert. It was Soldier Field, and it was one of those nights when it was, you know, 5 below 0 in July, and it was the wind off of the lake. It was freezing. There were two opening acts, and the man in front of me was so stoned that he kept falling down and cracking his head and standing up. And he had dried blood all over his body and was completely oblivious to this. And I felt unsafe. and he was, you know, tan as could be. So you knew that he had spent the entire summer following the Grateful Dead around and putting narcotics in his body and alcohol, thinking, wow, this is fun. And I finally turned to my friend about 45 minutes. They played this, you know how the Grateful Dead sometimes will, they'll get into a groove with a song. This is what I've heard. I don't know.
And it'll go on for an hour.
It'll go on for an hour, and everyone thinks it's the greatest thing in the world. I was ready to tear my hair out. So I finally turned to my friend, and I said, I'm sorry, I must leave. I cannot be here any longer. So we left. And they're probably the only person in the history of the planet to walk out on a Grateful Dead concert.
Well, needless to say, then, I guess you're not going.
No.
Even if you could get a ticket.
Even if I could get a ticket.
You know, they're charging like $500 for upper balcony. Well, they don't call it the balcony, but upper level seats with no view of the stage.
What do you look at?
I think you look at the back of the stage and you can just hear the music, or they're charging $500 or $600 on the second.
And Jerry Garcia is dead, for which I'm grateful because I could never stand him.
I used to have a Jerry Garcia tie, though.
Did you?
And if I was going to go to the Dead concert, I'd wear a tie and it would be a Jerry Garcia tie.
Talk about the lovely tie that I gave you for your birthday.
Lovely tie. I have a, well, some would call it an irrational or I don't know.
A loony
fear of sharks. Now, I say there are certain things in the world that are worthwhile being afraid of. I wouldn't say you should be afraid of, like, kittens or tricycles. However, I think a shark is a good thing to be afraid of.
You won't go into a pond in Kalamazoo, Michigan, because you think there might be a shark there. I've never known you to wade in any body of water.
There's a thing called a Kalamazoo freshwater hammerhead.
Yes. They're very dangerous.
You may think that that's just somebody who goes to the university there, but it's not. It's an actual thing, and I know they exist. And I guarantee that there is at least one shark just waiting for a meal in Lake Michigan. Without question.
It could have. I don't think it's
a shark. At any rate,
but
I don't.
You will never go in a body of water except for a swimming pool.
I don't think it's an inordinate fear. I think it's a very rational fear. I just don't like it. I don't like going into anything above
my knees.
It's
the only thing that I really know that you're afraid of.
Yeah.
Sharks.
Anyway, you gave me this lovely tie called Hammer Time, and it's got tiny, tiny little hammerhead sharks swimming on it in a beautiful azure blue background.
I couldn't have designed it better.
You know, I wore it to work yesterday.
You did?
Yeah.
Did you receive comments on it?
No, no one said a thing. Have you watched the last Downton Abbey?
No, I'm not finished.
Speaking of sharks,
because are there sharks in Downton Abbey?
I'm sure there's some in that pond, you know, where they go fishing.
And you know, they're sort of running out of story ideas, so maybe next year Lady Mary will have a tragic encounter in the...
Oh, you haven't seen the last episode?
No.
Oh
my God, have you told me more than I need to know? I'm watching it slowly, because I'm going to be so grief-stricken when it's finally over and I have to wait another year. So I'm about an hour into the finale.
Well, it's only an hour more to go. What are they doing? Yeah. Are they on the hunting trip? Or are they on the...
Yes, they're on the hunting trip.
Yeah, yeah. That's quite something, mm-hmm. Going off shooting.
It's lovely.
You know, there's a story I read in the paper this week about the L'Oreal heiress, L'Oreal, the makeup company heiress, which sounds like it's a real life story. Of course, it sounds like it's written. It's an episode of Downton Abbey written by, like, Jacqueline Suzanne on Quaaludes or something. It is unbelievable, the trial that's going on. You know, she's 90-something, 92 years old, and she's the heir to the L'Oreal cosmetics fortune. She lives in this little town in France, pretty much owns the town, and she's been being sort of wined and dined by this photographer for a number of years, and now her only daughter is accusing the photographer of bilking her out of billions and billions of dollars of stuff, and the servants are involved, and they're all testifying in the case. And
she has Alzheimer's disease, right?
Apparently, she has some sort of dementia going on. Yeah, but I'm sure you've read it. But it's a whole.
This happens to everyone with money who lives. Brooke Astor.
Brooke
Astor lived to be 104.
That was a tragic story.
And they put her 86-year-old son on trial for trying to build her estate.
He went to jail.
He did.
Yeah.
At 86.
I think he's still in jail. He's never going to get out, I don't think.
Sad.
Hey, did you know that there's a list of the top 10 favorite TV personalities that came out? Guess who do you think is the top favorite TV personality?
Currently?
Yes, according to the Lakeview newspaper.
The Lakeview newspaper of Lakeview, Illinois?
Of Lakeview, Chicago, Illinois.
Lakeview, yeah. Chicago. I would guess Ellen DeGeneres.
It is indeed Ellen DeGeneres.
Everyone loves Ellen.
Everybody loves Ellen. Do you know who else might be on the list? Jimmy Fallon. Tom Selleck is on the list.
Is he on TV?
Yeah,
I think he's
on like NCIS or some show. Yes, he's made a huge comeback. He's making millions. Mark Harmon is on the list. Steve Harvey. My brother's wife's mother loves the Steve Harvey show. Every time we see her on
really. Doesn't he host Family Feud?
Sometimes.
And they have these episodes, and it's always a black family versus a white family.
Yeah, we go over for the holidays, and her name is Ida, and you know, it'll be Thanksgiving, and we'll be talking, and she's like, well, you know, Steve Harvey said the other day, and the table just shuts up and listens, kind of like that commercial with the old stockbroker. When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. When Steve Harvey talks, Jim Parsons is on the list, Stephen Colbert as well, and Bill O'Reilly. Is also on the list.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Did you hear about the latest Bill O'Reilly scandal?
Tell me.
About the Kennedy assassination. He's written a book in which he claims that he went to call when he was working in the 70s, and the Kennedy assassination had been reopened by the House Select Committee on Assassinations. There was a man who was a white Russian. We could discuss what exactly a white Russian is. They were
it's Kahlua, vodka, and cream.
Well, that too. But these were by the 1960s, they would have been the children and the grandchildren of the people who fled Russia when it became communist and were favorably disposed towards the Tsar. They didn't have a problem with all of that. And I don't know how to pronounce his last name. It was George Demorenshield, something like that. He'd befriended Lee Harvey Oswald in Dallas, and he was called to. And it was very mysterious as to why this man of a certain age and wealth and esteem would befriend a 21-year-old psychopath like Lee Harvey Oswald. So in 1979, he was called to testify to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and he responded to his subpoena by blowing his brains out, committed suicide so he wouldn't have to testify. But Bill O'Reilly claims that he was knocking on the door when the shot was fired. He was knocking on George's front door. And he's said this repeatedly on TV, and it has been disproven repeatedly since then. So he's just making things up.
Yeah, but I'm sure he's sticking by his story, though.
He's sticking by his story. This is the thing with TV people these days. They make things up and expect to get away with
it. This is the kind of story that virtually can't be disproved, because what if he was? Who's going to
say? No, it was disproved because they found earlier reporting, because they know when exactly he died, and Bill O'Reilly was not in Florida that day.
And there's
day.
Not going to be any Brian Williams repercussions against from this.
What do you O'Reilly. Think Fox is going to suspend their biggest talent?
No, what I love about the Bill O'Reilly show is that everything he says is actually then printed on a little screen just to the left of his head for those people who really can't hear when they're at home. Word for word, it keeps coming
really?
Up. It's like closed captioned without the closed caption.
Do you watch the Bill O'Reilly Show?
No, but we see highlights on the Daily Show and on Colbert, and they'll show it, and he'll talk, and the words will just come up exactly as he's saying them. I'm going, how stupid do you have to be? Or deaf. Or deaf to watch the
I watch Downton Abbey sometimes with the subtitles on.
Because it's easier to understand them?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that Lady Mary? Didn't she look absolutely gorgeous this year?
She's more beautiful.
After she had that bob haircut, mm-hmm. that 20s haircut?
Yeah. Every time she's on screen, it looks like
so
a John
Singer
Sargent.
So you didn't see the ending.
Painting.
So you don't know about Lady Edith's rampage at the shooting club, right? You know, Lady Edith goes a little... Oh.
Berserk.
Berserk.
I don't believe you. You're toying with me.
I'm not toying with you. But you're right not to believe me. Hey, do you know what the top 10 best perceived brand names are in America? What would you think the top perceived brand name in America
in terms
is?
Of trustworthiness?
Yeah.
A brand I can respect, a brand I look up to. General Electric, Ford.
Ford is number 9.
Mattel, McDonald's, Coca-Cola.
Amazon. Amazon is the number 1 best perceived brand, followed by YouTube, Netflix, and Subway. You know what the number 10 one is? Cheerios. I was looking through this Lakeview newspaper, speaking of...
Why are you reading the Lakeview? Where do you get the Lakeview newspaper?
Oh, it's
everywhere. Do they just give it away?
It's everywhere. One of my favorite little articles on the side here was in the senior news line. I thought, that's kind of interesting. There's a bunch of seniors in Lakeview. What's this one about? Looking for love online? Beware. It's advice on how to not get jilted while you're online. So some of the things they want you to do is find out if the dating site does background checks. Most of them don't. Anyone can sign up, and the dating site is happy to take their money. Or... the minute someone asks you for money, stop communicating immediately. I think that's wise advice. It doesn't matter what the reason. Never give so much as 1 cent. Beware if the person claims to be overseas in the military or recently widowed. Many states have sex offender databases. Check. This is in the senior newsline. I don't think seniors need to be afraid of sex offenders. They need to be afraid of people jilting them for money. Do a search online. Use Google.
Use Google.
By the way,
tell my mother to use Google.
By the way, Google is number 6 in the best perceived
I trust
list.
Google.
I trust Google too, you know. So you can look under the person's name and find their real name, because a lot of people use aliases or screen names. Put in the name and click images to see if you spot familiar pictures. If you're sent a photograph, it might be a fake. Yeah, you could send a photograph to some old lady at the chalet retirement home here in Evanston of George Clooney. Say, hi, I'd like to meet you. I'd like to meet you for lunch. Beware suitors who are too quick to declare love or ask for marriage. Take a close look at the person's social media page. Does it look real? Well, I don't have a social media page, so they're never going to know. Check the dating site scams form to see if you recognize any names. Take someone with you if you decide to meet this person. I think that's pretty good advice.
Hi, I'm here for my first date. This is my friend Midge. She's going to monitor our time together.
So did you run into many? You were at Davenport's last night. Davenport's the old and venerable cabaret club here.
Yeah,
we
should probably explain what that is in case our listeners haven't been there.
Well, besides what I've said, what would you say?
I would say it's the last place in Chicago that one can go to hear cabaret music, and they bring in some New York talent. There's two rooms. There's a back showroom. There's a front room where they have a more casual piano bar.
So you went last night and you were in the back room.
I was in the back room to see an evening of Stephen Sondheim. Because, you know, not a week goes by that I don't have to go listen to some Stephen Sondheim something.
Brilliant. Not a week goes by, not a blessed week.
Not a blessed week. And this was a woman of a certain age who had a fine voice. And I said, you know, she's good, but there's no sense of occasion. She sort of wandered on stage and started singing. For my money, if I'm paying money to see a
performer. Did you actually say those words?
Yes.
That pretentiously?
Yes.
Did you say it in a sort of a high-pitched tone?
No, I knew him.
Nasally?
Oh. And I said, she's fine. But she sort of came on stage and said, you know, today is Stephen Sondheim's 85th birthday. This week is his 85th birthday, so we're going to be doing some songs. Now, a true performer would walk on stage with her arms outstretched, hello, here I am. Aren't you excited to be here? I'm so thrilled to be here. I'm thinking of, you know, your Liza Minnelli's, your Barbara Streisand's, your Bette Midler's. They just don't meander on stage and start, you know, singing. Anyone can whistle. That's what they say. It's like, hello, ba-ba-boom, I'm here. And so it took her a while to get warmed up. You know, once she got going, she was fine. And I don't want to hurt this poor woman's feelings, so I won't mention her name.
What sort of repertoire was she singing? Did she have a theme to the show?
Like, it was Stephen Sondheim.
But other than Sondheim, was there a theme like love songs or travel songs, or were they from a particular couple of shows, or was it just all over the map?
It was all over the map and predictable. Anyone Can Whistle, Send in the Clowns, Not a Day Goes By, Being Alive. You know, haven't I heard, you know, I could sing these songs in my sleep. I'm still
sorry,
here.
Sorry, are you still
and
talking?
Yes, a truncated version of I'm Still Here. But Becky Menzies.
Truncated version of I'm Still Here.
A truncated version of I'm Still Here.
You can't sing the short version.
I know.
The reason it's the length it is because she's still here.
She's still here.
That's what that.
Yeah. Good times and bum times, I've seen them all, and my dear, here's to the ladies who lunch. It's like, really? What a segue.
Oh.
So I slapped the pianist after the show was over. It was Becky Menzies, actually. I didn't, but I believe she was responsible for that arrangement.
Oh.
And she's the redoubtable Becky Menzies.
Is that who you went to see?
Becky Menzies? She was playing the piano
for
the woman who was singing. She was the accompanist.
I see.
And at one point, she began to do some kind of patter singing. And she didn't need the keyboards, and Becky Menzies ended up slapping the side of the piano. So for a good 5 minutes, Becky's sitting there going, pounding on the piano.
I've seen her do that with Michael.
It was
with
the
Tom
most,
Michael before.
It was the most absurd visual to see this someone slapping away at the piano.
Oh, gosh. Well, I haven't seen Good Cabaret in a long time.
When was the last time you saw Good Cabaret?
Oh, probably last time I went to Davenport's or something, or you know, we saw Becky and Tom Michael somewhere.
They sang at your wedding.
Remember when we used to go to the Whitehall Hotel Thursday nights or something?
And it was free.
And it was free, and we'd sit in those loungy chairs or on those sofas and listen to them sing from one end of the room. Mm-hmm. Those were dreamy,
thrilling,
awesome nights. I was at WFMT the other night, the local classical radio station, 98.7, here on your Chicago dial. We were doing a live broadcast of some pieces of the classical ensemble that I work for right now, and it was sort of fun to be at the radio station because I haven't been at one for a little while, and to be inside the recording room and watch the people in the booths, although it wasn't very well manned. There were only a couple of people doing the whole thing. It's all digital now. They push a button. So you used to work in radio.
Used to work in radio, and I actually was at Bloomberg Radio in New York a couple of months ago. And, of course, everything's digital. And I said to the woman who was producing, I used to work in radio, and I said, back in my day, we had magnetic tape. Everything was on 7-inch reels, and you had to cut it by eyesight. You'd hear the soundbite that you want, and then you'd reach up with a wax pencil, and that's where you need to slice the tape with a razor blade.
Yeah.
And she said, I have no idea what you're talking about. I might have been telling her I'd worked in a gramophone factory.
Indeed. Yeah, his master's voice. When I was a kid, radio was a huge part of our lives. The radio was always on, either at home or out in the backyard when we were sitting around in the summertime or in the car. There was always something or somebody to listen to. What do you think about
it? Do you listen to talk radio where people just, you know, like, listen to WGN, and we'd always listen to people chit-chat? And
every once in a while, but not very much anymore.
Not as much anymore, no.
You worked at a radio station that your family owned out east.
I worked at WPUV in Pulaski, Virginia.
What did the PUV, did it stand for anything, or just the call letters?
PU must have stood for Pulaski.
Pulaski. Well, you know, we have a Pulaski Pulaski, we call it.
Yeah, well, but in Virginia, they called it Pulaski.
Really?
Here we call it Pulaski. Pulaski, right?
Yeah.
Named for the same guy, general in the...
The Revolutionary War.
Yeah, Polish.
The father of the American cavalry.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'll tell you about that. My father spent a lot of money for that radio. Sorry if I had a brief accident here in the studio.
Drop my diaphragm.
My father spent a considerable amount of money for WPUV 30 years ago, and I was in Pulaski, Virginia recently, and we tried to find the radio station, and I couldn't find it. And I stopped at the local newspaper, and I said, I explained, you know, I'd lived in town 30 years ago, my father owned a radio station, I can't seem to find the radio station. And they said, oh, the radio station went out of business. And once upon a time, you probably know this, with radio, licenses were worth a lot of money because there's only so many places on the dial. So even a small...
Bandwidth.
So even a small radio station, that license was worth a lot of money. And I went out with some guys that I worked in radio with, and I told them, I said, this astonishing story. My father's radio station went into business. He goes, it's happening all over the country. Small AM stations are closing. And one of the problems they have is radio is deregulated. I've been very mad at Ronald Reagan for deregulating radio and causing this to happen. And then I learned it happened under Clinton, not under Reagan. But what happened is that it meant every radio station in the country is now owned by two companies. And everything is on satellite. So in places like Lafayette, Indiana, my father started in Lafayette, Indiana, there is no local broadcast anymore. It's piped in syndicated satellite shows. And one of the reasons you had radio stations was if a tornado is coming, you broadcast an emergency alert. So they've had problems now for years where a tornado is coming to small townville, Oklahoma, and they have no way of getting that message out to the people because the local radio station's running syndicated broadcasting and there's no one physically at the radio.
Well, they have, you know, the emergency alert system now where sirens go off in various towns, so you don't need to be listening to the radio.
But you had both of those.
Back when we were kids.
Back when we were kids.
And I think that maybe that's a reason why podcasting has taken off as a way to fill that niche.
Yeah, people like to listen to people talk.
People like to listen to people talk.
They're part of the conversation.
And you can just sit back and just listen to it happen, and there's no, you know, we're not doing call-ins here, and there's no commercials.
Which is another thing, it's heard radio. That's why people want to listen to satellite radio.
Well, exactly. You know, WFMT still does not do any commercial advertising on air. Everything has to be read by the on-air personality.
Right.
So
they don't do pre-recorded ads.
Yeah, you don't get a car dealership or anything like that doing it with jingles. You just get the person reading it. How about the Chicago Flower Show?
The Chicago Flower Show.
Chicago Flower and Garden Show is coming up.
It's very popular. It's at McCormick Place, which is a hideous building that's difficult to get to. You have to drive there.
I have to correct you there. It's been changed over to Navy Pier. It's not a McCormick Place anymore.
So what is the point? You go to a show to look at flowers.
Well, I think they have flowers, and it's a gardening show as well. So they have landscaped gardens giving you ideas about what you can do, even though you and I live on the fourth floor apartments. What do we get?
That'll be very useful for me to learn about gardening.
Oh, sweetie, a little Japanese waterfall over there in the corner would just look lovely in here, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And, you know, we have winter, 8.5 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what Chicago gardeners are all about. They're all desperate. Place is going to be mobbed. I think we ought to make an effort to go out to the garden show and have a look at it. I think there might be some interest, some interesting things to be reported.
I could put flower baskets on my back porch.
You could, and you get lots of afternoon sun.
I do.
You could get those hanging baskets. Mm-hmm. You could maybe get some good ideas. Anyway, the Chicago Flower and Garden Show is indeed at Navy Pier, March 14th through 22nd. Tickets
I believe
are on sale.
WGN will be broadcasting live from there every day because there's a lot to say about the Flower and Garden Show.
There is.
Yes, tickets are only $18, and there's lots of flowers here, and it's quite a thing. And if you're coming, you want to make sure to take the east entrance route and not the west entrance route because that's a little backed up. But it's quite thrilling, and we're going to have a booth there, and you're going to meet some of the great talent from WGN, and we have plastic water bottles we'll be giving out with our WGN logo. They're working on a Barack Obama poinsettia because it's going to be in honor of him. It's a poinsettia that the flowers are almost black, which is very difficult. They're actually a deep purple. It's impossible to breed a black poinsettia, but it's as close as they can get it.
Is it a sort of a hybrid between a Hawaiian and a Kenyan poinsettia plant?
That's clever. I'm not sure. Are there poinsettias in Kenya?
I'm just asking.
Could we get our producer to look that up on Google? Are there poinsettias in Kenya? I don't know. And
we might have to call into
very WG. Careful about talking about race and ethnic origin on this show because we don't want to offend anybody or look tasteless.
At any rate, the Garden and the Flower Show is at Navy Pier March 14th through 22nd. Tickets are indeed, well, they're $17 for weekdays. Weekend, $15 for weekdays, only $5 if you want to bring a child.
Really? I've been a child really enjoy that.
Woo-hoo!
Yes. Hey, little Billy, look at the flowers. I hate you. You know, what's wrong with the lilies? It's a little Christian. They always have an Easter lily show at Lincoln Park, the Lincoln Park Conservatory. And it's a million Easter lilies in the shape of the cross in a gigantic room.
Where is this?
At the Lincoln Park Conservatory. The Lincoln Park is a large park on the lakefront in Chicago between Fullerton and North Avenue.
Well, where's the conservatory? I know where the zoo is. I know where Lincoln Park is.
It's on the northern part of the zoo. It's been there since the 1890s. It's world famous.
Mm.
It's thick with the smell of flowers and plants. It often
I know of the Garfield Park Conservatory, just a little west of town. I'm sure
did you go there?
I've been there.
It's a convenient neighborhood to get to.
It's a lovely neighborhood. Hey, Leonard Nimoy died this week, and I'm the hugest Star Trek fan, but I don't really have a lot to say about it that hasn't already been said.
What do you say? You know, I wasn't, because I was a Lost in Space fan, and as a child, I wasn't mature enough to understand that
Danger,
Star Trek
Will
was
Robinson. Just
that Star Trek was a whole different thing. You know, that was much more intellectual, and it was about things other than June Lockhart being afraid.
She was usually always afraid, or making dinner,
or making dinner.
Or sometimes both.
And Angela Cartwright was in Lost in Space. She was one of the children in The Sound of Music.
She was indeed.
And I thought, I did have one start, because I knew we were going to talk about Leonard Nimoy's passing. And the only thing I could think of was that once upon a time, a friend of mine was dating someone who claimed to have written an episode of Star Trek. When he was a senior in college in a writing program, he came up with a great idea and he sold it. And then I thought, you know what? Everyone has that story. Everyone knows someone who claims they wrote an episode of Star Trek, so how do you really know?
Did he ever mention what it was about?
He did, but this was 30 years ago, and I can't remember. So it was sort of a non-story, which is why you don't bring these things up, even on podcasts. but that's life. As we go through life, you know, Leonard Nimoy dies, you have a half-remembered memory about something and you can't remember the whole story.
Well, you have a remarkable memory for things that happened 50 or 60 years ago. I'm surprised you don't remember this kid's story, because I've seen every episode multiple times. But
is that literally true?
Yeah.
You say that about movies. How many times have you seen The Great Race? I've seen that innumerable times. How many times have you seen Ben-Hur? Innumerable times.
Yeah, yeah. Many, many, many times. I watch movies over and over again. I watch Star Trek over and over again, too.
Do you read? Do you read books?
I have been known to read a book, sure.
Okay.
So you're a man of books.
You're a man of many interests.
What books are you reading right now?
I just got a new, very exciting biography of Barbara Stanwyck.
Really? That big, fat one that's only like half her life?
Yes,
it's 900 pages.
900 pages. Barbara Stanwyck up to the age of 30. I could live to be 116, and you couldn't come up with 800 pages to write about me.
Well, this is why I love, as you know, the well-written, well-conceived obituary. And we're sort of segueing into our Kiss of Death segment here. He passed away this week at the age of 83 in Bel Air. He was a photographer. He was a poet. He was a sometimes singer, though I wouldn't recommend those. And, you know, he came from a bit of a theatrical background, a stage background, and he frequently performed on stage. I don't know if you know this, but a notable Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. Can you see it?
After Star Trek?
Yeah, indeed.
Wasn't he born to Orthodox Jewish parents, or did I make that up?
He was. Born in Boston on March 26, 1931. Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Leonard Simon Nimoy was the son of Max and Dora Nimoy, Ukrainian immigrants and Orthodox Jews.
Wow.
And his father worked as a barber. From the age of 8, he acted in local productions, winning parts in community college, where he performed through his high school years. After taking a summer course at Boston College, he traveled to Hollywood, though it wasn't until 1951 that he landed parts in two small films, Queen for a Day and Rhubarb. I'm sure those are movies you've watched over and over and over again. He was cast a lot in little-known movies, though he did play an alien in a movie called Zombies of the Stratosphere, and in 1961 had a minor role in an episode of The Twilight Zone. First starring movie role came in 52 with Kid Monk Baroni, in which he played a disfigured Italian street gang leader who becomes a boxer. Now, who thought that up? He served in the Army for a couple of years. He directed and starred as, this is crazy, he directed and starred as Stanley Kowalski in the Atlanta Theater Guild's production of A Streetcar Named Desire right after he was discharged from the military. This was between wars. I mean, this was not in World War I. He was in the military in
World
the
War
early
II.
50s. World War II. He was in the 50s. So he returned to California, where he worked as a soda jerk, movie usher, and cab driver while studying acting at the Pasadena Playhouse. And then he did a bunch of television roles, Wagon Train and Rawhide. He was on Perry Mason. Of course, who wasn't on Perry Mason? Robert Redford was on a Perry Mason episode, for God's sakes. He received an Emmy nomination in 1982 for A Woman Called Golda, in which he portrayed the husband of Golda Meir, the Prime Minister of Israel, who was played by...
Anne Bancroft.
Ingrid Bergman.
It was her last performance. She was ill with cancer when she filmed
it. It was. And it was his fourth Emmy nomination, 3 for Star Trek, which he never won. In 2002, having illustrated books of poetry with his photographs, he published a book of photographs called Shekinah, with a Jewish theme, that of the feminine aspect of God. Black and white photographs of nude and semi-nude women struck some Orthodox Jewish leaders as heretical, but Mr. Nimoy asserted that his work was consistent with the teachings of the Kabbalah. To this day, I sense Vulcan speech patterns, he once said, Vulcan social attitudes and even Vulcan patterns of logic and emotional suppression in my behavior. You know, there's not too many people who created characters in either a film or especially on television that are now part of our social consciousness. Everybody knows what Star Trek is. Everybody, some people probably believe there really is a Vulcan. And we know so much about that race and that planet just through this character.
And Vulcans had no emotion. Was that their deal?
Yeah, they had gone through a very warlike, barbaric phase in their evolution. And in order to stop the killing, they adopted a system of pure logic so that emotion would be suppressed and hence anger, hatred, racial prejudice, religious persecution, all of those things would be suppressed in favor of reason and logic. And so they evolved purposely to that level. Of course, Spock's mother was human, so he always had both sides of that warring against each other, which also made him a great character. But, you know, I came across something, again, a couple of days ago, and it's much more interesting. Harv Bennett died.
Do I not get to say anything about Leonard Nimoy?
You can. Do you have something to add?
Well, did you mention that he wrote two books? I Am Not Spock.
And I Am Spock.
And I Am Spock.
Yes, he did.
But this book...
I guess he didn't think very long about
this
second
Jewish
title.
Black and white photograph Kabbalah book.
Yeah.
Yeah, can you... Like, what was the audience for that? Hey, Gary, happy birthday. I bought you a new album, a new $50 book of photographs by Leonard Nimoy. Isn't that exciting?
If you walked into somebody's house and saw that on the coffee table, what would you be like?
It's like, my God, you were the biggest loser in the history of the planet. Why would you want to own this book? And what were his recordings? He made these famous, terrible albums, or terribly famous albums.
He did make some terribly famous albums.
Didn't he do things like MacArthur Park? Or am I mixing him up with William Shatner?
William Shatner did those. Okay. Yeah, MacArthur Park is melting in the rain. That's a very famous version of that song. But listen, Harve Bennett died, and this was shocking to me because, well, first of all, I didn't know he was still alive. And secondly, coming on the heels of this, from shortly before his 11th birthday to the age of 16, Harve Fishman, as he was known, was a regular on The Quiz Kids, a wildly popular 1940s radio show that taxed the panel of pint-sized intellectuals with questions sent in by listeners, like, here's a question, would a bathtub drain quicker if you continue to sit in the tub after pulling the plug? Or if you dug a hole from Denver to sea level and jumped in, how long would it take you to hit the bottom? And they'd call in and they'd ask these kids on the radio. Wow. These scores of young panelists served on the Quiz Kids over the years, but Harve was among the most renowned, a jack of all knowledge. In adulthood, Mr. Bennett was best known for producing four of the original six Star Trek movies, starting with Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan.
Well, look at this. There's been two Star Trek tragedies.
It's 84. Star Trek II, Star Trek V. In 1982. His death came 2 days before that of Leonard Nimoy, who played Spock in all six films in the original TV series, but was only announced this week. And Mr. Bennett also served several noted miniseries, produced several miniseries called Rich Man, Poor Man, with Nick Nolte, made him a star. And From Here to Eternity with Natalie Wood and William Devane. Remember that TV movie?
Yes, the remake. Tragic Natalie Wood. We'll have to do an entire podcast on Natalie Wood someday.
Yeah, I think we should. Mr. Bennett was born in Chicago in 1930. His parents' aspirations for him were inscribed in his very name, Harvard Bennett Fishman, hence the name Harve, but Harvard was it at 10, and his own initiative. Harve auditioned for the Quiz Kids and soon became a household commodity. At 16, the show's mandatory retirement, quote, on age for its young stars, it's faded off the air and in some cases into obscurity. One panelist, however, Joseph D. Watson, would go on to map the molecular structure of DNA with Francis Crick and Maurice Wilkins, work that earned them a Nobel Prize.
Wow.
You have a Nobel Prize, brush with a Nobel Prize.
I do have a brush.
You were in New York recently.
At a party at Alfred Stieglitz's apartment on Riverside Drive. It was a book signing party, and he won the Nobel Prize in economics a few years ago. And I was with a friend who will remain nameless, who had a few glasses of wine and then decided that she would wander through the house trying to find his Nobel Prize. But she was shooed out of the room by the caterers.
Do you know that, if let's say you won a Nobel Prize. Excuse me. Sorry. Let's say you won a Nobel Prize. Would you ever consider selling that medallion?
Somebody's trying to sell one. Do you have that article as well?
The Nobel Medal awarded to economist Simon Kuznets in 1971 sold Thursday at auction for $390,000.
Wow, you bet.
This was the first medal to sell in the field of economics. Speaking of economics, Nobels, and one of only a handful of 889 medals awarded since 1901 ever to have been sold. The actual medallion is made of 23-karat gold and is worth about $8,700. But that was not too far from the price paid for a Nobel Prize in physics awarded to James Chadwick for his discovery of the neutron. It sold for $329,000 last year. And in 2012, William Faulkner's estate hoped to sell his 49 Nobel Prize in Literature for at least $500,000, but the sale was called off when the bids topped out at $425,000. Other Nobel medalists have sold for far more. James D. Watson, Francis Crick, and Maurice Wilkins received the prize in 1962 for their co-discovery of the double helix structure of DNA. James D. Watson, co-Quiz Kid member with Harve Bennett.
No.
It's
a small world.
Yeah. Mr. Watson's medal, purchased by a Russian entrepreneur, sold for $4.76 million in 2014.
And what was that for?
For discovering the helix structure of DNA.
Wow.
Nothing too significant.
Wow.
Just a little sort of world-changing discovery. And not long after, Crick's medal sold posthumously for $2.27 million. Though Mr. Bennett was too old to appear on the television incarnation of the Quiz Kids, which began in 1949 and never rivaled the success of the radio version, he did eventually build a career in TV. He was the producer or executive producer of a string of shows in the 70s, including, these are great shows too, The Mod Squad, The Invisible Man, The $6 Million Man, and The Bionic Woman.
Wow, kind of a one-trick pony.
They couldn't think of other names. Over the long run, he once said, the fame and success, I believe, had a totally positive effect on me. But I went through a period of several years after leaving the show when I suppose I was experiencing a classic letdown, like a lot of child actors who have achieved too much too soon. You're familiar with a lot of child actors and their histories in Hollywood. You're a bit of a well, I don't know if it's an expert, but certainly an aficionado of the silent era.
Mm-hmm.
And
they always end badly.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do know a woman. Should I tell you about Baby Peggy? I'll tell you about Baby Peggy for 2 minutes, but we won't belabor this. Baby Peggy made her first movie in 1922 at the age of two. She is still alive. She worked for a company that wasn't a major studio, but she was the equivalent of Jackie Coogan at the time. There were Baby Peggy dolls, Baby Peggy postcards.
Mm-hmm.
And as she got older and was no longer a baby, the film company didn't renew her career, and there was nothing for her to do, and her career was over. And guess what? This is what always happens. A well-meaning relative comes in, says, I'll invest your money. I'm going to double this money. He lost the family's fortune, and they ended up by the Depression living in squalor and dire poverty for years. And she had been a child star so young that she barely remembered it. And whenever anyone would bring up her Hollywood career, her father would become livid and furious. And as years went by, and she later went to work for the University of California, she came interested in what became of these films of her, and there were just no prints of them. So she traveled all around the country going to different film archives, and she finally found five of the movies that she had made. But I was with her once at Grauman's Chinese Theater, and she had a very specific memory from the 20s of being at a movie opening. It was a Mary Pickford film, and she and Jackie Coogan were there and talking in the courtyard. And she's still here and still alive, and I would think, you know, what an interesting thing. You have someone from the silent era still alive. One of her movies, she was Clara Bow's little sister.
Wow.
You know, Clara Bow's been dead for 50 years, and you have someone with this connection to the early part of Hollywood.
Wow.
She was actually the mascot for the 19... It would precede the Depression. Let's say, when was Franklin Roosevelt first elected? 32?
Yeah.
She was the mascot for the Democratic Convention that year.
The mascot.
Yeah, the mascot. That's how it was built.
The poster child.
No, I think she was there on stage and was. I don't know. I read that it was the mascot. Now you're going to argue with me over something I just read and I can't verify.
Validate. No, I love that she was the mascot.
But she was there. You would have thought that 100 years later they would bring her back when Barack Obama is being reelected. But no one cares about the past.
No one cares about the past. And here's a perfect example of that. This was just a small blurb that I found. Alice Matthias Hammerstein, the daughter of Oscar Hammerstein II and Myra Finn, died Thursday at the age of 93.
Wow.
According to her daughter, Melinda Walsh, the cause was pneumonia. For many years, she was the Hammerstein family representative to the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization and continued to be the spokeswoman for her father's work, with the insight of having seen the original production of Showboat in 1927.
Wow.
She addressed the cast of the musical's New York Philharmonic concert performance last fall in the revival during rehearsal. As a young woman, she worked for her father doing research on specific subjects to support her father's lyrics, becoming immersed in the tradition, for instance, of the New England clam bake for the song A Real Nice Clam Bake from Carousel. The material presented to her father often far exceeded what was necessary, something she attributed to what she termed research poisoning. The recipient of several ASCAP awards, she was the lyricist and co-author of Babes in Toyland, an adaptation of the Victor Herbert operetta, and she also wrote English lyrics to Franz Lehár's The Merry Widow and Johann Strauss's A Night in Venice, all of which were presented in the repertory of Light Opera of Manhattan. She was also the associate with conductor Thomas Schumann and his Little Orchestra Society, for whom she translated lyrics of the American premiere of Richard Strauss's Intermezzo and adopted Mozart's The Magic Flute. So in 1985, she wrote and produced a musical centennial tribute to Jerome Kern called The Music is Kern, and was proud of having hired the then-unknown Susan Stroman to direct.
Oh, interesting.
She enjoyed a lively correspondence with her father from 1928 until his death in 1960, and carefully saved the letters, which were warm, chatty, encouraging, and sometimes stern. Oscar treasured his daughter's precocious and painstakingly detailed notes, and they were returned to her upon his death. Over the years, she worked on a book that included all the letters, from which she titled From O to Ah. Her hope to publish the book was cut short by her death. Again, someone who lived through an era and had that sort of historical knowledge brought forward. 93, it would have been a joy to have spent some time with her in her later years.
And I need to point out, you're reading from a paid death announcement. That's not an obituary. That's not a news story.
It is not a news story. It was paid for by her family, who will miss her cockeyed, optimistic view of the world, as they say. Thanks. But you know what? Enough about me. We should probably segue into the segment that we call No One Ever Lets Ross Talk.
No One Ever Lets Ross Talk.
Do you have something share with us
before that
today,
noise
Ross?
Started, I had something about... Oh, this is what I wanted to... Oscar Hammerstein died in 1960, right?
Correct.
You just said that. Do you remember several years ago we had the pleasure of seeing that great entertainer Marie Osmond in concert doing her Christmas show?
I do, and I had you meet her backstage after the show.
Yes, and at one point she said that she was going to break with what people associated with it, and she was going to do two songs from The Sound of Music. Was it The Sound of Music and The King and I? And she said, I did these on Broadway because Rodgers and Hammerstein asked me to. And I thought, Oscar Hammerstein was dead about 6 years before you were born, you delusional, crazy person.
Well, it was probably the estate of Oscar Hammerstein.
Yes, but that's not what she said.
But that's not what she said, right?
Yeah,
as if she knew them.
Yeah, why don't I just say that Abraham Lincoln asked me to give the Gettysburg Address at his centennial?
Well, I suppose they could have asked her in the late 50s, and she'd been holding...
She wasn't
and
alive
she'd been
yet.
Back. She's not that old?
She's
got to be in her mid to late 50s, right?
Maybe 40s, I would think.
Really? Yeah,
and here was the capper. She got right in front of the mic and she sounded terrific on those numbers. And I talked to someone at intermission and she said, well, she sounded great because she's lip syncing. So you can imagine how crazy is that? Let's go watch Marie Osmond lie about why she's singing a song and then she doesn't sing the song. And can we say this on our podcast? She was crazy as a loon.
She was loony.
Yeah, do you remember this? She didn't know that she had to do a meet and greet with the audience after the show. And she was already, you know, taking off her clothes and her makeup and was getting ready to get on her bus to drive to Kentucky where her next gig was.
Yes.
And someone said, Marie, you've got to do a meet and greet. Well, she did her makeup again. She got all dressed up. She put on hose. Is that what women call them now? Hose, nylon stockings? You know, she didn't pull on a pair of blue jeans.
I think so,
okay,
yes.
Yeah. She got all glammed up. And then she came downstairs to talk to people, and I just sort of said hello to her, and wow, you really do have great teeth. All Mormons have great teeth. This is fascinating to me. It's because there's lots of interbreeding, and they all are bred to have good teeth, and they don't eat sugar or smoke or drink coffee or drink red wine, so their teeth stay pearly white.
Hmm.
Look at Mitt Romney.
You know this empirically?
This is evidence-based medicine.
On observation?
This is based on having spoken with many Mormons, and I've never seen a Mormon with a bad mouth of teeth.
I see.
Warren Beatty is making a new movie. Have you heard about this?
It's a Howard Hughes movie.
It's a Howard Hughes movie. He finished filming it 9 months ago.
But they keep filming little scenes here and there.
Right, and they said he's notoriously detail oriented,
meticulous.
He'll go back into reshoots just to do to film a dog walking in front of a 7-Eleven.
And he's playing Howard Hughes. But from what I understand, the movie is morphing into a story a little differently. I mean, it's not just the Howard Hughes story any longer. It's something else. It's
no one's seen it. No one knows anything.
What are you
saying?
Aren't there big stars in this movie too?
Who knows?
I think there are.
Annette Bening.
I know she's
because,
in it.
You know, she doesn't get work unless her husband casts her. That was perhaps unfair. She's a good actress, but she doesn't work enough, and I think she should have been a bigger star and had more opportunity. And she always, every time she's nominated for an Oscar, she loses to that great star Hilary Swank.
Well, every movie that Hilary Swank does, she wins the Oscar for.
Yes. Either Hilary Swank makes a movie and it's direct to video, or she wins an Academy Award.
Am I remembering this correctly? Does Warren Beatty have like 12 or 14 nominations?
He has a whole bunch of Oscar nominations.
A passel of them. And he's only won for one, Reds, right?
Yes, directing, best director.
Directing
like
for
Robert
Reds.
Redford. You know, great actor, doesn't win for acting, wins for directing.
Yeah, I thought he had tons of
And I think the year that he won for Reds, he beat something like Martin Scorsese for Raging Bull, you know, one of the great movies of all time.
But let's give it to
Warren Beatty for an incomprehensible four-hour soap opera.
Yeah.
With all these... Didn't you remember that movie? They would have people who were part of the story from the teens in the 20s who were then very old people, and they'd be interviewed on camera briefly, and Warren Beatty said, we don't need to explain who these people are. Everyone will know. Yes, I'm Emma Goldman's brother. Like, we would all recognize him. Oh, it was absolutely inscrutable. What a pretentious film.
It is long and almost unwatchable.
But what's interesting to me is, you know, for my money, Warren Beatty was about the handsomest man who ever lived as a young man. Along with Paul Newman, you know, who was ever handsomer than the two of them. As the years have aged, you know, with everyone, it's all about bone structure. And I read recently, was it Warren Beatty who said good looks is 90% good hair?
It could very well have been, yes.
And he's always had a good head of hair, but I think he's probably had some tinkering done. And his last film, his last movie was Town and Country. Do you remember this? It was a notorious flop.
Brutal.
And it was filmed over several years, and they kept going back and doing retakes. And as the cast aged and as they had various forms of plastic surgery, people's faces would change from shot to shot. You'd have Diane Keaton sitting on a couch, and then they cut to a close-up, and her crow's feet are gone. But his last major film was Love Affair with Annette Bening. And he forced Katharine Hepburn to play his mother or his aunt, and it was the last thing that she ever did, and she was about 106. And he'd had a lot of plastic surgery. Do you remember Splendor in the Grass, whenever Natalie Wood would have a close-up? She would walk in, and the lights would be just on her eyes.
Yeah, there'd be a key light across her eyes.
So they did the same thing with Warren Beatty to hide his age, and so no matter
they're supposed to be very, very young in that movie.
Well, yeah, but yeah, it's based on who was the original movie? Irene Dunne and Cary Grant, yeah, Love Affair, yeah. And it just was a vanity vehicle, and it was kind of grotesque. And Warren Beatty's 70 what now?
Yeah, 70 something.
Well, let's say he was 21 in 1961 when he made Splendor in the Grass. And that would be 55 years ago, so he would be 76.
Now, you would admit, of course, that Warren Beatty is a true movie star.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So we were watching the Oscars the other week. In fact, you were over. We were watching them together. And at one point during all of those best sound editing, best sound mixing, best production set decoration, yada, yada, yada. They'd come up and they'd yammer on. And I finally got fed up with that. Do you remember what I said?
You said, where are the stars?
I said, where are the movie stars?
Where are the movie stars?
I want to see movie stars. I'm watching where are the movie stars? And yeah, we decided that you know, there's so few movie stars these
days.
Well,
could they bring out a Jane Fonda or a Warren Beatty or a Robert Redford to
No, they bring out these television people.
They look like streetwalkers.
And these people, I'm not saying these people don't deserve Oscars for their sound and for their cinematography and blah, 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 blah. Of course they do, but...
I'm talking about the presenters.
Yeah.
Could we get a higher caliber of presenter?
I miss the studio system. Frankly, I think we should bring back the studio system.
Debbie Reynolds misses the studio
system.
Where
we sign them to ironclad contracts. We make them and we break them. We create pasts for them and then.
So please don't pound on the table.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. I felt like Nikita Khrushchev there for a moment. But yeah, I mean, I'm as apoplectic as Nikita about this.
And as you should be.
Yeah, I think I should be.
It's a tragedy.
Well, it's been a fun talk sports there, Roscoe.
Let me close with a quote, and this might help us frame up the next time we get together. This is from Eleanor Roosevelt. Great minds discuss ideas. Average minds discuss events. Small minds discuss people. Had she been here, she would have said, smaller minds discuss movie stars.
Let's talk about Eleanor Roosevelt for a moment.
Let's talk about Eleanor Roosevelt. Not, you know, she was not an attractive woman.
But she had great ideas.
She had great ideas. And I had a sort of a poignant story. We moved around a lot when I was a child because my father was a minister and somewhat unpopular and had to find a new congregation every 4 years. But I had a very specific memory of living in Louisville, Kentucky. And there was an old maid who went to our church who lived in a apartment by herself downtown. And even as a 6-year-old, I could understand, you know, this furniture is 50 years old. This is a couch she got from her mother. There were doilies on, you know, the couch arms and everything. And it just seemed very old and still. And I thought, how sad that this woman's all alone and her whole, you know, not even a cat or a, you know, maybe she had a plant. And, you know, there's no living thing in this apartment. Little did I know that would be my fate years later. But the salient...
I was wondering if you were telling your life story or something else.
No, the salient detail was she had apparently written to the Roosevelts when they were in the White House about something. And I think she sent them a Christmas present. And she had a lovely letter from Eleanor Roosevelt that was framed and on her coffee table. And that was her most valued possession. And so the last time I saw my mother, I mentioned this to her. And she was absolutely astonished that I could remember something that from that visit. And she knew exactly what I was talking about. And this was, you know, I was in this person's apartment once 50 years ago. That's the power of Eleanor Roosevelt. She stays with you.
She does indeed. Well, we hope this podcast stays with all of you until our very next one, which won't be too long. We're going to try to make a visit down to the Chicago Flower and Garden Show. And,
I'm looking forward to that.
And have a little report from there. We'll let you know what that's all about.
Great.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Take care.
Happy birthday, Gary.
Appreciate that.